Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It is I, the host. I'm Cindy House, and welcome. Happy September. Happy fall. Hope everything is going just great with you. We have today on the podcast Jeffrey Foucault, talking a lot about his best friend, Billy Conway, on the new album, Universal Fire, which if you are listening on the release day of this podcast, it's out tomorrow. You have to wait 24 hours to listen to this record. If you're listening after that, the record's out. It's awesome. All right, before we get into Jeff, let's talk about a couple things here at Basic Folk. There's three things that we always talk about at the top of the pod. That is the newsletter. Are you on it? If you are, well, that is just fantastic. High five to you. If you're not, you can sign up. It is a once a month email that lets you know what's going on with your favorite little folk podcast. Sign up at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. to sign up there. That is the best way if you want to stay in touch with us. That's the best way to do it. You can also, if you'd rather not, you can also sign up or follow us. I guess you don't sign up for social media. You can follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And the last thing we like to talk about is that we are listener supported. So if you'd like to make a small contribution in any amount, there is a link in the show notes to do so. Or you can check out basicfolk.com, make your contribution there. And thank you so much. Jeffrey Foucault. In our episode with Wisconsin-born, New England-based Jeffrey Foucault, we had a handful of questions for the singer-songwriter about his background. Coffee, the Midwest, Mark Twain wisdom. Then we talked about Billy Conway for more than an hour. If you are not aware, Billy Conway was Foucault's longtime partner in music, drummer, and best friend. Billy died from cancer in 2021. He was a rock and roll roots legend in Boston with his tenure in Morphine and Treater Right. He was like a holy man known for his creative, curious, and infectious spirit, where even people who met him only one time, myself included, were quite taken and inspired by his presence. The loss of Billy Conway hit the music community hard. In 2023, a tribute album showcasing the songwriting of Conway, recorded by some of his closest friends like Chris Smither, Foucault, Chris Delmhorst, Billy's wife, Lori Sargent, was released. And now with his latest album release, Jeffrey Foucault's given us a working wake for his friend Billy, the Universal Fire. We talk about what was going on with Jeff when he met and started working with Billy in 2023, like what state of mind made this spectacular friendship and collaboration completely click, how conscious Jeff has been about his reaction to Conway's death and processing grief when it comes to being an example for his teenage daughter, who's also been getting into music and performance. Hello, Hazel. We also dig into the new album, The Universal Fire. He paralleled the loss of Billy Conway with a different type of loss, the 2008 fire at the Universal Studios lot in California that destroyed master tapes of hugely influential American recordings. And finally, a check-in on how Jeffrey's humanness is faring in the high-tech world in the year 2024. One of my favorites, Jeffrey Foucault. Hope you enjoy. We're going to take a listen to the title track from the new album. Here's The Universal Fire, and we'll get to our conversation with Jeffrey Foucault on Basic Folk.
Our religion was electric. magnetic singing on a wire. Invisible ways making kings out of slaves and cutting off freedom and desire. And we pulled it down from the sky to make us dance, to make us cry. And one night it all burned away. In the universal fire. Shuttles rocking in the loom of night. 10 million souls weighed out in silver and gold. 2 million gone straight to light. And they wept and they moaned and they called down the intercession of some nameless choir. But the angel just let them keep singing till the night that it all burned away. In the universal fire, gravity pushes down the stylus. God disappears into the sky. Electroplated silver cuts the master from the mirror. Everyone, the iteration of a lie. We have Satchmo and the killer at sunrise. We have Bo Diddley and Big Mama and John Lee. And every soul now lostless in heaven. Until the night that it all. You can try to square the circle down, but the God that you serve is the God of the curve, the irreducible mystery all around.
Jeffrey Foucault, welcome to Basic Folk. What a dream come true.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
In getting ready to talk to you today, something that kept coming up over and over again was coffee. And it seems like coffee has been your loyal companion for most of your life. What has your relationship to coffee looked like? Like starting when you were very young, like who was drinking coffee around you? What did it symbolize then? What does it mean now?
That's a good question. Everybody drank coffee. I came from, you know, the Midwest. So, you know, all my grandparents drank coffee all day long and they drank it with supper. But it was super weak. Like you could see the bottom of the cup, right? So you could drink 30 cups of Presbyterian coffee, yeah, in 1970 or whatever. But I started drinking it. You know, when I was a kid, we had an old Mallard camper trailer that when I was real small, we could fit my parents, the dog, and three boys in this little tiny thing. You know, the little couch would fold out to a bed for my folks. There's a drop-down bunk for one of my brothers. And then the little sort of kitchen booth thing with a table, that would drop down, and we could put two boys head to toe on that thing. And then the dog would be under the fold-out bed. And,
amazing.
Yeah, we'd go out camping in the North Woods, but when I got old enough to be in the bunk that dropped down, my bed and the pillow was right above the coffee percolator on the little propane stove. So I would come home from camping and my pillowcase would smell like coffee. And then when I was like 17, it's a good question because at 17, I learned to play guitar by staying up all night and learning to play guitar in the house, just super quiet while everybody was sleeping. And then that was the same month that I learned to drink coffee, because there's no way to stay up unless I made a big cup of coffee.
Mm.
And then I'd sleep through high school.
Nice. And then how about now? What does it symbolize for you now?
You know, I mean, everybody's got their, I think, you know, at least the people that I have known who do what I do, everybody's got their little cocktail. Sometimes it's an actual cocktail, or more than one. But I don't think I've ever written anything when I wasn't drinking coffee. Like, and mm-hmm. and just in the sense that it's a really useful, very reliable stimulant for me. So my mm-hmm. brain starts, you know, like my wife Chris will make fun of me because I start talking too much and I got too many things going in my brain about an hour after I have a cup of coffee in the morning, you know.
Do you ever try to quit drinking coffee?
No, mm-hmm. absolutely not. I had one day where I had to wait like 6 hours since I was 17. I think there was one time where I didn't get a cup of coffee right away, and it was because I was trying to cross the border into Canada at Windsor to open up for Chris Smither. And I had borrowed $50 from my brother to afford the gas. Then I drove over to my folks' house and I borrowed $50 from my mom. So I had $100 to get to Port Dover, Ontario from Wisconsin. And the guy that was running the gate, you know, they had me come inside and show my paperwork. And this was back, they used to have two kinds of paperwork. One for clubs that had like 51% of their income from food and beverage, and one for clubs that had 51% from entertainment. And if you didn't have the right one and your Dudley Do-Right Mountie knew the difference between the paperwork, then he would stop you. And he was like, you can't come into the country. And I was like, well, here's the thing. If I don't get into the country, I can't get home because I don't have any money. And I'm 6 hours from soundcheck right now, and it's 6 hours to Port Dover, and I really need to come into Canada. So we had to, like, go after this for a while. But I had expected to just sail through the border at, like, 7 a.m., so I hadn't had a cup of coffee, and it took me hours to get through the border. And then, so, yeah, that was, like, the worst thing ever. I have never actually had any impulse to quit at all.
Yeah. My dad will go back and forth. I think now he's into coffee, but I mean, yeah, thanks for talking about that. It's kind of a strange way to start the interview, but it just like kept coming up and coming up, coming up. So cool. I read some of your posts on your website. Like, it's kind of like your blog, your news portion, but it's like, are they your newsletters or they're just
yeah,
like,
it's just if you updates. Sign up for the newsletter, I send one once a month, and regardless of geography, you have to just hear me talk about random bullshit that attends to my life, you know?
No, it's good. I was reading some of those posts. You were talking about, this is a while back, you were talking about dropping out of college when you were a junior because you couldn't figure out why you were there. And something that really struck me that said, until that time, I had done more or less what I was supposed to do. And when grown people asked what I was doing, the answer always seemed to make them happy. What's been your experience with like doing what you're told and following the rules, and how has that evolved?
Hmm. Well, I was the youngest of three boys, right? So I had two very well-behaved brothers ahead of me. And so they were supposed to do the work like an icebreaker, right? Like they're supposed to be out there chopping away, but they didn't. They were both very good. And I think I had a pretty good idea from a young age that I was less good, at least in the sense of behaving myself. And I was also probably more interested in sampling the variousness of life, especially in my teen years, right? So, you know, I think all things considered, I was a pretty good kid. I was a terrible high school student, you know, like my folks at least talked about putting me in military school. Because halfway through every semester, I'd be failing every class because I just wouldn't turn anything in or pay any attention to what they asked me to do. I was kind of off in my own world, which was fine, but it didn't make for a very peaceful home life with my folks. I think, you know, I have a 16-year-old now, so I understand it's like if you don't have something to measure your kid by and all the things that you use to measure, you know, they're not particularly interested in, that can be difficult. But so I can sympathize with them now. But at the time, it was just hard to do what I was expected to do. And I didn't want to. And I think in the most basic sense, I didn't want to do what everybody was doing. And then I got older, you know, and I read Mark Twain, and he said, anytime you find yourself comfortably in the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. And I thought that's a good way to approach your life, right? Hmm. Look around and decide whether or not you want to be trying to more or less just find your own way without worrying about what, you know, whether it pleases people or not.
Hmm. Another thing about you is the Midwest. It's a big thing when dealing with Jeffrey Foucault, especially the state of Wisconsin, which I was just in. I was just in Kenosha.
Kenosha, hey.
I didn't have any cheese curds, unfortunately, but
yeah.
I saw a wide variety.
You know, it's funny because when you come up from Chicago and you go through Racine and Kenosha, you see just like 8 million signs for cheese. And if you're going up to Wisconsin Dells from sort of the same deal, if you're coming up from Chicago, going through Beloit and into Madison and then up to the Dells, same deal. You just see like all these signs for cheese. But I grew up in neither of those places, sort of in between them, more or less. And so I didn't think we had a whole lot more cheese than anybody else until I got out in the rest of the world. People be, you know, the moment you say you're from Wisconsin, they'd be like, oh yeah, the cheese. And I was like, cheese, how about brandy? Like, we lead the nation in brandy consumption and obesity and any other bunch of different things, you know. But
You've been given the vibe title of rugged Midwestern sensibility. What does that mean to you?
It's, you know, there are people who get paid to write about records and albums.
So somebody wrote that about you is what you're saying.
Yeah, we should be glad that they do. Every once in a while they come up with something that where you're like, well, that's an interesting thing to say. I mean, it's hard. It's difficult for me to imagine what a rugged sensibility is exactly, but I get what they're trying to say, right? Which is like,
you used to smoke.
Yeah, right.
And you chop wood.
I used to smoke. Right. I've like, sometimes I go outside, you know, I could see,
flannel shirts,
right. Flannel shirt, the beard, you know,
have you driven a tractor?
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah, I worked on a farm when I dropped out of college. So we had an old Ford tractor that anybody who's worked on a farm would recognize from the 40s, run forever. And then when I worked for the University of Wisconsin on the grounds crew, I got to drive the big, you know, the hydrostatic, you know, rig, like big tractors and earth movers and stuff. I wasn't supposed to, but the guys that I worked with, I was, you're a limited term employee. They don't want you to handle all the stuff, but the guys that I worked with were totally willing to let me drive the,
what was it, the 90s,
the big rigs. Yeah, it was the 90s.
Yeah, you know, the rough and tumble 90s. Here's another question about you when you were younger. When you were a young guy, you seem to have spent your days working like odd jobs, handyman stuff, substitute teaching. Mm-hmm. You live 10 miles from your hometown. This was, again, from another one of your mailing list newsletters.
Yeah.
You said, when I go home, I think about this guy. I haven't seen him in years. So how do you relate to that guy now?
You have done your homework. This is fascinating. what I was writing about when I wrote that down is I was thinking about that time, that sort of liminal space, but where you're trying to figure out what you're going to do. You know, I was lucky because my dad had, you know, having three boys to pay for school, that was going to be hard, and we didn't have a ton of money. So he made a deal and said, if you go to a state school, I'll pay tuition if you pay room and board and books. And he made that deal with all three of us. And so we all ended up going to state schools. And I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I got out. I dropped out. I went back. I got out. And then, but because he had paid for tuition, I didn't, I think in contrast to a lot of people now, I didn't have any debt to worry about, which meant I didn't have to get a job right away that paid enough for me to pay down my bills, right? I just, I could kind of float. So I would do whatever job came along, and I would do it for exactly enough days to pay the rent and the groceries. And then I would take a week off and write songs and go fishing. And, you know, and I didn't have extravagant habits at that point. You know, I was living on like sandwiches and coffee and beer, and I was perfectly happy in a way, but I was waiting to see what was going to happen. And I didn't know what I wanted that to be. It was funny because my wife, Chris, and I are coming up on our 20th anniversary in September, and we were just rusticating back in Wisconsin together, and we were talking about it. And I said that it was way harder decision to make my first record than it was to get married. Like, getting married to me was the simplest decision ever, but deciding whether or not I was going to make a record, I lost sleep over. And it sounds dumb, but, you know, when you're that age, if you have any awareness at all, you know that when you open one door, you close a bunch of other doors. And I was, you know, I had these ideas about like, well, if I do this thing, if I commit to this, then I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to work on a fishing boat in Alaska. And I'm not going to be a smoke jumper in Washington State, or like all these things that I had to at least consider doing. Whether I was going to do them or not was immaterial. It just felt like I couldn't sacrifice the possibility. Yeah.
Yeah. God, listening to that story, how you were just like working some jobs, take a week off, write songs. I don't think I could have done that. I feel like I would have been like too anxious about like what's going to happen next. Where was like anxiety and like drive?
I think anxiety really ramped up with the internet. Not so much for
in general
for me, but for everybody.
For everybody, okay.
Yeah, I don't remember being anxious. What made me anxious was sitting in 10th grade algebra trying to figure out what on earth I could do in the world that I would not absolutely hate. So sitting there and thinking every job that I knew about didn't appeal to me really at that point. And so, you know, there's that worry that there's no reasonable place for you in the world. It's not like I didn't know how to work. I could get a job, I could do anything, but I wanted to do something I actually wanted to do. And I had already proven myself really terrible at doing things that I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. So, I think that was foremost in my mind, was just, how are you going to be in the world? I wasn't worried about how it would go. I was worried about getting away with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the rest of this interview, full disclosure, is about Billy.
Okay. Good. He would appreciate that. I know he would love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to have him on. But it didn't work out. So 2013, you started your musical partnership with the late Billy Conway, who your new album is written for, an incredible person that you have written a lot about. One thing that you wrote that resonated with me, because I met Billy one time. You said people who met him once would remember and remark him, and it was his odd magic to be in the soul, to be the soul in per...
That's a hard
reading
one.
Skills today. Yeah. These are all hard ones. I need to go to sleep. People who met him once would remember and remark him, and it was his odd magic to be the soul in whose presence wisdom might reveal itself. Another thing you wrote about him, he showed up when I needed him, when I was about ready to give up on music, and he took me gently by the arm and walked me back into my life and my work. God, I don't know. I don't know. You've written such beautiful things about Billy. What was going on with you when you first met Billy Conway, and what made you so open to this friend and collaborator?
I'll circle back. That first thing where I said he was this person that, you know, when he was around, wisdom could reveal itself. I was cribbing from a book called Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez, a writer who I really, really loved. And that there's an actual word for that in I think it's It could be Inupiaq. Anyway, it's one of the nations of the very north, you know, above the Arctic Circle. And the word is Asumatak, and it's that idea that there's a person. They don't necessarily give you the wisdom, but when they're there, it makes it possible for wisdom to materialize, right? And I always thought that was a great description of Bill, because he had a strange way of being able to bring out the best in any number of people, you know. He was complicated, and so you never want to paint somebody into a cartoon silhouette, but that was certainly a thing about him. So to go back, let's see. I'll give you the story that I think about a lot that describes how I was feeling around the time I started playing with Billy Duo, which is like I was having some trouble with folks that I worked with, and I was not getting enough work, and I didn't know why. I just thought nobody wanted to book me. It turned out that was not the case, but there was a tour where I was going out to California. I was flying across the country, right? Normally when you do that, you want to be working for 2 or 3 weeks and working almost every night. Maybe you got a Monday or a Tuesday off. And this was like, play a couple of easy, you know, sort of cherry pick shows, have a couple of days off, which is not terrible, but it was frustrating to me at the time. And then like another private show, and then another thing. And I was doing a private show, and I don't mind doing private shows. It's, you know, it's not something I did for quite a while, but then I got to where I enjoyed it, just because I know what it's like to go around and play in bars and clubs and theaters and festivals. But you know, every once in a while you have a very interesting experience, for better or worse, when you play in somebody's, you know, thing. And I played this thing, and it was one of those deals where probably the guy's wife had wanted me to come, and he was sort of vaguely interested but not really, and he and his buddies were going to stand in the kitchen and talk about football while I played in the backyard. And cool. Except on the other, they set me up on the opposite side of like a kidney shaped pool. And they built this little stage thing that was kind of like, you know, we just had the Olympics, you know, when they have everybody on the three, you know, like put me on the top one. Like I just gold medaled in folk music. That's where I was standing, right by the pool. And I'll try to collapse this story so it doesn't lose any steam. But things began to unravel as the show began to ramp up, and there was an opener, and the opener showed up, and like he didn't have shoes on, and he had like 40 different pedals on his pedal board, and I was like, I could see it coming. I was like, this guy's not going to play a half an hour, right? Like there wasn't even an opener on the contract, but I was like, he's probably going to play for a really long time. And sure enough, you know, he's on stage for about an hour before I was like, all right, I'm just gonna start drinking, which is, you know, a character flaw in this scenario. But the guy had, you know, put a bottle of bourbon in my little green room space, whatever that was. And
you are from Wisconsin.
And I'm out there waiting to go on and do this thing, and I was just especially at that time in my life, I was really very defended when I played for music for people, right? When I was on stage, I almost always held something back. And so I was not always like a comfortable performer, especially in those first 10 years or so that I was on the road. And you know, so I was in my cups, and I get up on this thing, and I was really three sheets to the wind, which I don't like to play that way at all. And, you know, I'm standing up on this pedestal thing, trying not to fall into someone's pool and electrocute myself holding a guitar. And that was, you know, I left and I drove, you know, I got in my car, said my, you know, goodbyes, did all that stuff. I got in my car and I drove around the block. And then sat there because I was not sober enough to drive a car. So I had to sit in the car for like, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour before I felt like it was reasonable for me to drive to my hotel. And then I got to my hotel, and I was, I mean, that was about as sad, I think, as I ever was on the road. And I was tired of being by myself. And I'd watched people, friends of mine who had just like really destroyed their ability to enjoy playing music for people by doing it the wrong way for a long time. And then not long after that, I flew out to Montana and I was doing some shows, and Billy was living in Wilsall, and I had a show in Bozeman. We set up his little suitcase kit in the family room of his place, and we just played for like, I don't know, an hour and a half or something like it. And we had never played duo except maybe one time in the studio at that point. We had cut a couple records together by then, and we had toured together, but we never just played the two of us. We always had a full rock band. And, you know, I plugged into a little amp, and I was, the whole time we were playing, I was thinking, wow, this actually really works fine. It's very musical. I can play all these kinds of music. You know, I can play blues music and country music and sort of folk or trad music, rock and roll. It's all, pretty nimble. And I was like, hey, do you want to come down and just set up and play at this radio show that I'm doing tonight? And he was like, yeah, yeah, I'll come down. And we drove over the bridges together, and we played that show. I think it might have been a double hitter. And then at the end of the night, we drove back over the bridges to Wilsall, and it was that was it. I was like, oh, this is the thing that I've been looking for. I had a pretty good idea right then, you know, that it was like, this is musically the piece that slots in. And then I think, you know, when I said I was like thinking about walking away, I had certainly always at least considered the possibility that this wasn't the thing that I needed to be doing, and I could do something else. And it was important to me to keep that in my brain, right? Like, I don't have to do this. I could do some other thing. Mm-hmm. And then, after about a year being on the road with Bill, it was so good, and it was so fun and fulfilling that it was actually felt almost disorienting or like dangerous, you know. But I didn't feel like, he taught me that I didn't have to be defended to be up on stage, right? Like, you can, because it's not about you. It doesn't have that much to do with you. It's another plane of experience when you're really doing it, and you're playing well, and you're playing together. It doesn't have that much to do with you. It's a thing. It's a place you get to visit, but it's not your place. And then, you know, suddenly I could be, I could be vulnerable, which is a different form of strength or whatever. You know?
Billy had some success and found fame with bands like Morphine, Treat Her Right, and it's said on your website that he has played with everyone from Bob Dylan to Bo Diddley, but walked away from that life. Why did he change course, and how did his view of that kind of fame impact yours?
Well, he walked away because Mark Sandman, the lead singer of Morphine, died on stage in Palestrina, Italy. And that was the end of the band. You know, that band was such a specific thing, right? Just drums and saxophone and two string slide bass. And at one point somebody asked what kind of music it was, and Mark was being a smartass, and he said it's low rock because it was all low sounds. And that's why they ran with it. And then they were like the low rock pioneers, but it was all kind of, you know, silly. But they were super cool, and they didn't sound like anybody else, and they were such a light footprint. But that thing, watching it ramp up for Bill, the way he talked about it, you know, he'd done all that stuff. You know, they were big enough in France, it made sense to fly to Paris for three shows and come home, right? And it's hard for me to say what would have happened with that band if Mark had managed to keep going. But I know Bill felt like it had more or less run its course. And, you know, he had a little farm with his partner, Lori, up in New Hampshire at that point. And he liked working. He liked working on his place, and he liked working in the studio and making records with youngsters, which is what he started doing around that time, around 2000, producing records for, you know, he would say he was producing if that's what somebody wanted, but he didn't care about the title. He liked calling it Record Shepherd because it was like a more catch-all term, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, he got credited on stuff he was not in the room for, and he got no credit on stuff that he probably made every meaningful decision, right? So he started working in the studio, and he started getting the calls because that band, you know, he was a hot ticket as a drummer. And without mentioning names, people would call and say, "Do you want this gig?" And it'd be a profile gig with somebody famous. And he would say, "Well, are they nice?" And they'd say, "Well, no, not really."
Are they nice?
And he'd be like, "Well, I don't want to do it then." And I think he just didn't want to do it. I think he, you know, it's an interesting thing about Billy. He was all set to go play on the 80 Olympic hockey team, the one that beat the Russians. Those were all his buddies. And he was the captain of the team at Yale, and he was a phenom in high school in Minnesota. And so he was like an elite level athlete. And then the guy who was the coach of that Olympic team flew him out for two exhibition matches in Minnesota. And the first one, he lit it up and outscored everybody and skated like a maniac. And the next one, he destroyed his knee. And that was it. He wasn't going to get to go to the Olympics. And, you know, later on, he said he was glad because it would have defined his life in a way that I think he wasn't keen on. Or it would have been difficult to live down if you're on a postage stamp or whatever. But what he did at that point, he said he stopped trying to do things and he kind of gave up on ambition. That was the first time there was something he really wanted and he worked his ass off to get it and it didn't happen. And it was frustrating enough for him that he said he just kind of, waited to see what would happen next. And that was really the way he went through his life after that. He kind of floated downstream and wanted to see, you know, what was going to happen. And it was a very open way to be. And it made it so that he had a very interesting experience because he wasn't ambitious, right? Like he could have taken the Sleepy LaBeef gig when that guy called and but he didn't, you know, he could have taken whatever.
Who's Sleepy LaBeef?
Sleepy LaBeef. You don't know Sleepy LaBeef? He was a rockabilly guy. He called Billy one night. He'd fired his drummer yet again. He called him in the middle of the night. He's like, "Billy Conway, I hear you got the big beat." Then he said, "I guess so." You know, he said, "Do you want to come join my band like tomorrow?" Then Bill said, "No, I don't think I do."
Sleepy LaBeef. You've written extensively about your friendship with Billy, that you're not quite sure where his views ended and yours began. And together you spent about 120 nights a year on the road. And it sounds like a type of marriage that the two of you had, even though you both have female partners. And I'm not trying to be weird about this, but I just wondered, can you talk about what it's like to have this level of intimacy with a man?
Well, I grew up with brothers, and so I was sharing a room with somebody for most of the first part of my life. And then I played sports in high school, and I had a lot of good friends. I think I've always had closer, until Bill, I was always, most of my real close friends had been women. But, you know, on some level, we've probably lost sight of what I think historically would constitute meaningful friendship over the course of a long life. And maybe that's not true, but it seems to me that it just people fade in and out of each other's lives in a way that they maybe didn't do when everybody kind of stayed in one spot. We weren't hopping around from one place to another. Bill and I carried our little civilization wherever we went, right? So like I would get up at 3 a.m. and make a cup of coffee and start driving to Hartford to get on an airplane. And I would get a text on the way. Billy was either at the airport in Bozeman or on his way there. And then we would fly across the country. And sometimes we'd walk out from opposite gates, you know, having arrived from different places, and we'd get the rental car. And then we'd go back to this other life, which was, it's like that. I think I'm sure you found this when you talk to people. You know, your road is one life and your home life is another life. And sometimes when you're in one, you forget the other one ever existed. And when you go back to the road, you think it never ended. It's the same tour that you've been on since you were 25 or whatever. And our relationship, you know, sometimes we had separate hotel rooms, but frequently I was just not making enough money to get separate hotel rooms and still pay him fairly and do all that stuff. So I'd say, you know, here's the deal. Early on, I think I said, if you want a separate room, we can do that, you know, every night, or I can just pay you more and we can get a room with two beds. And so most of the time on the road, we shared a room, just depending on the scenario. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's like summer camp with drinks. You know, you're laying there talking about stuff until you fall asleep, and you get up in the morning and you talk about stuff. And Billy was interested in everything. So it was a very easy conversation to have without it ever finding any particular conclusion. You know, we also drove for 6 or 7 hours many times. And sometimes we didn't talk for an hour and a half because companionable silence is a lovely thing. You know, we were pretty good at that. So it wasn't, I don't think I would necessarily say that I knew him better than anybody else did. I mean, I knew him better than some people did. I'm sure his wife, Lori, and various of his friends knew a different part of him than I did. We just had this, you know, we had our particular friendship, which I think, it wasn't any different than any other deep friendship. And in its way, you know, we used to make jokes about it. Like when we'd go on the road with Lori, right, we'd make jokes about, because then they would share a room and, and I'd be by myself and I would say, well, you know, there was something I was going to tell you last night, Bill, but you weren't there, you know. And we'd make jokes, you know, she and I would both come out of the gas station with like an egg salad sandwich for Bill, and we'd look at each other and kind of be like, oh, I guess you were getting it, you know. I can't remember what she called me. It was some other thing. It wasn't like sister wife or some goofy thing, you know.
Road wife,
yeah.
That's a good one. Did your friendship with Billy make you a different kind of friend?
Yeah. Billy had the ability to make people want to please him, or I guess, is that the right way to put that? No, people looked up to him in a way that, you know, I've watched it over and over again. Sound guys would barely know him and they would seem desperate not to disappoint him, which I always thought was an interesting charisma to have. It's a good power to have, I guess, if you're a traveling musician.
That's no easy feat.
But in the sense that he made me a better friend, he probably made me a better person, and that hopefully, you know, trickled down into all of my friendships. But I think I would have to give it some thought maybe to answer that question adequately. But I think he's maybe one of the only people that I've never wittingly disappointed, if that makes sense. You know, like, I'm sure I disappointed him. Don't get me wrong. I bet it happened regularly. But it was never because I was being intentionally, you know, obtuse or selfish or, you know, whatever. I was trying to do right by him because I really did value our friendship.
The album Further On, The Songs of Billy Conway, was released January 2023. It's a collection of some of the songs that Billy wrote. Some of these songs he wrote while he was dying, and some were going back to the 80s. And it's a bunch of his closest friends and musical companions performing these different songs. When you are, I imagine that you're very familiar with the songs on this record. If you're not, tell me and I won't ask this question. But what differences do you notice between his early songs and those he wrote at the end of his life? And like, what insights do those later songs give you on what he was going through?
I think his younger songs, he was often writing sort of, you know, tongue in cheek, even when that's a beautiful song. Like the song my daughter sang on that record is a gospel tune, called Trouble in Heaven. And it is a beautiful, very well wrought, gospel number that he wrote for a joke album with a buddy of his called, I can't remember. I'm not sure what the album was called. It might've been called King Jesus North Pole Radio. He was a big one for a gag, and he liked a backstory, right? So the backstory for that band was that they were, I think it was Live at Gospel Ranch. That was it. King Jesus North Pole Radio Live at Gospel Ranch. The fake story was that there was a radio station at the North Pole broadcasting, like Christian music, and they were the band, right? And so that was, so all the songs were sort of, the songs feel like songs by the band.
Wow.
In the way that they're sort of Big Pink, you know, sort of thrown together. Mm-hmm. A lot of people playing different stuff. And that song, but then you hear it, you know, in the mouth of, I guess Hazel must have been, 12 or 13 when she recorded that. And it's,
no
such,
way.
And it's so timeless, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. She was just a baby.
She's amazing.
She was such good friends with Billy. I mean, they were really tight. So that was a nice thing to get her singing on one of his tunes. Yeah.
Yeah. So Hazel is the teenager now.
Mm-hmm.
How has being her dad influenced the way that you've been honoring Billy after he's died? Like, what example about grief and death are you trying to give Hazel?
I don't know how conscious it was, but my own experience of losing a dear friend, somebody who was such a big part of my life, I knew I was going to have trouble if I didn't do something very intentional, right? You know, most Aboriginal cultures, when somebody dies, you know, they would mourn by doing something physical, right? Like if you're a Lakota, you're going to slash your arms with a knife, and you're going to cut all your hair off and rub ashes all over your body, right? I didn't feel like that was probably appropriate for me to do. But the reason you do stuff like that is because scars heal over, hair grows back, and you have a physical manifestation of the period of time that's going to pass before you feel even anything approaching normal. And so maybe a month after Bill died, I rented a little cabin that just had a wood stove and a bed and a chair and a desk. And I wrote some of the songs that are on this record, started a few of them, you know, tinkered with a few things, but mostly I was there for a week just by myself, not talking to anybody, and trying to spend a certain amount of time every day just paying attention to how I felt. It's better to, you're going to deal with it badly, or you're going to deal with it less badly, right? You're going to deal with it either way. You may as well do it by squaring up to it and looking straight at it. So I did that for a week. And then that whole month, there was a month after Bill died where I would listen to a piece of music, the same piece of music every day at the same time. And, you know, 5 o'clock, I'd have a drink and I would listen to the live recording from Belgium, I think, of The Sinking of the Titanic by Gavin Bryars. And it's exactly an hour long. It's very nonlinear, modernist composition, but it's very beautiful and evocative. And so I listened to it every night for a month. And at the end of that month, you know, now I will listen to it on the anniversary of his death and no other time, because it just will take me.
Why that piece?
A friend of mine had sent it to me, and I was thinking about it and familiar with it, and it was the right piece of music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's odd how things present themselves to you when you're in a state of mind like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say something else. There's another place in your writing about this record where the Titanic comes up. Now I know where it came from. I didn't make note of where it is in your writings, but.
I said that the fire at the Universal Studios felt like a metaphor.
That's it.
That was much like, you know, I mean, Bob Dylan wrote Desolation Row, right? About, I mean, the Titanic is one of the dominant metaphors in a song that's a bunch of interlocking metaphors and icons and images and all that stuff. But, you know, if there's a better metaphor for modernity and the problems associated with it, the Titanic's a pretty good one. So I was trying to get at the Universal Fire thing. I was hoping not to make like a statement. I was just trying to get after a question, right? Pose it as a question.
Yeah. I got to tell you, when I was getting ready for this interview, I had to look up a lot of words because you have quite the vocabulary.
Sorry.
The word you just threw out there, I'm like, I'm going to have to look that one up. Modernity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's just modernity, you know, like
the modern
era.
Can you just talk like a plain folk, a plebe?
I'm terrible at it. And I, you know, I went out to California after college and I ran this Y camp up in the mountains in Big Bear, east of LA, up in the mountains in the San Bernardinos, about 9,500 feet. And all my staff were coming from Los Angeles, right? And they were all younger than me by a few years. I was just out of college, so I must have been 22-ish. And these youngsters would sit down, we'd have our morning staff meeting, and I'd have my clipboard and my watch. I bought a watch for the summer. It's the only time I ever wore one. And I'm the program director, right? And I'm trying to just say, this is how it's going to go. And these are the things that we need to work on. And these are the things that you're doing well and all those things. And I just could not manage to pitch my I would always end up confusing people because I had a hard time not talking
like a teen,
like a book. Yeah. Well, I just,
how's Hazel's vocab?
It's pretty good. Pretty good. But mostly I think by osmosis, she could certainly stand to read more. Maybe she'll watch this and she'll hear me say, she won't watch this. We both know she won't watch this. She's got other things.
She might watch this. Hi Hazel. Yeah. What up?
Yeah.
Okay. Not one more. I've got a lot of more questions about Billy. One of the last things Billy said before he died that you wrote on your website, he said, "It's so beautiful."
Mm.
What do you think he meant?
All of it. I think he was an expansive soul, and he was, you know, those last 3 days he had, you know, it was very plain he was on his way out. Mostly it was about managing medications in a way where he could be comfortable and lucid. And that was a hard combination to get, right? You could get comfortable and sacrifice lucid, or you could get the other way around. And so there was a period there where, you know, it was a very beautiful thing. You know, it's a lucky thing to have a beautiful death. Most people don't work on it and most people don't achieve it. And he had a house full of people who loved him. This big old rambling farmhouse from the 1780s up there in New Hampshire, and all these people who had been in various parts of his life were wandering around, playing music in one room, cooking in another room, you know, dealing with the firewood, dealing with the animals. Somebody's got to go feed the horses. You know, there's all this, and everybody's just in and out, and people are going in and sitting down by the bed next to Bill. They moved a big old bed into one of the family rooms, sort of rooms in the house by the wood stove for that last month. And, you know, he was in bed and sometimes he might wake up and sort of, you could see him. He would sort of swim up into his eyes for a second and be present and look at you. And he would grin and then he would go away again. But I think he was probably listening. And so who knows? He could have been saying it was beautiful to be in that house full of people. He could have been, entirely lucid and unable to let anybody know that, or he could have been enjoying whatever version of consciousness he was pursuing right at that moment. But I think it was such a great, very much to type, you know, it was not a surprise that he would be as full of light as that, you know, even in extremity.
Yeah. you saying that, you know, not a lot of people get a beautiful death. This witnessing this with Billy must have changed your perspective on dying and death.
Well, you know, you live long enough and pretty soon your, you know, contact list and your phone starts to fill up with dead people. And that's part of the game. You know, you lose your grandparents, you lose people in your family, but, you know, I've been in the room with a baby being born, and now I've been in the room with somebody watching them die. And, you know, whatever, you can get into the metaphysics of what that is and what it means. And, but it is, you know, it's the dominant fact of being alive, right? We don't spend a whole great deal of time thinking about it, but it's worthwhile to pay attention. And it was, you know, Billy was obsessed with community, and I think he would have been very happy to form a commune and preside over the cantankerous meetings of various people who couldn't get along or share their resources, because he hated the idea that everybody had to be in their own little thing. And you know, you got five people living right next to each other and they all have the same lawnmower, right? That's stupid. He's like, why wouldn't you just get the one lawnmower and everybody take a turn? And he was the tail end of the baby boom. He was born in 56. So he was still just coming up in the summer of love and the hippies and all that stuff. And he was so disappointed with the hard turn that the left made in the 70s. You know, he felt like the moment Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, everybody who had been marching in the streets and talking about love and peace and justice, like, bought a Volvo and opened a coffee shop and started voting for Reagan. And he was pissed. So on some level, when his death was the occasion to bring, you know, 30 or 40 people into contact with each other for the last little while of his life and build that community around the fact of his dying, it was, you know, there's no other way to describe it. It was just really perfect. It was very beautiful. It was totally dovetailed with the way that he lived his life.
The album Universal Fire, if you're listening on the day this episode posts, it's out tomorrow. If you're listening after that, it's out now. The album, as we've been talking about, Billy Conway, it's a working wake for Billy. It's also about the 2008 fire at the Universal Studios lot in California. So is that just the title track about that, or is that also included in the other songs about the fire?
The fire is the big framework for the thing to me.
Okay.
But what the record is about is loss. So when you know, if you're...
So my question for you on this was, why parallel these two losses together? And then, bonus question, what wisdom have you gleaned from the song?
I don't know. You know, the first line of that song is, our religion was electric, right? And my religion, Billy's religion, the thing that we don't have when we no longer have a, what I would describe as a sort of uncynical relationship to a religious experience or a religious community, is you don't have that community to fall back on, and you don't have that simplicity of belief. Rock and roll and music was as close as I've ever come in some ways, and I think that was true of Billy. And so when I say our religion, I mean our religion, all of ours, but his and mine specifically in that instance. And the question to me was, like, if these things, if you can lose these things, which are just artifacts, and the artifacts are themselves bad imitations of the thing that actually happened, right? And every manufactured you know, copy is one sort of standard deviation away from the truth of that thing, you know, the thing that happened in a room when they were rolling tape. That was the thing itself,
the actual performance of the song.
Yeah, I mean,
it was then captured on the masters and then copied.
Yeah, and I mean, you can, yeah. You know, we all know you can catch a butterfly and put a pin through its body and stick it on a piece of wood or styrofoam like lepidopterists do. But at that point, you don't have a butterfly.
Lepidopterist.
Right. Lepidopterist. Yeah.
Cut it out.
Sorry. I'm just showing off.
Talk normal.
No, you know, like that, what you have at that point is something, but it's not a butterfly. And so to me, the open question about the record is, you know, and I was thinking about the pandemic and what it had meant to not get to play music for people that way for a couple of years and have to stay home. There are various versions of loss and dealing with loss in every song on that record. And to me, I wasn't trying to say, here's a conclusion I've made about what this means. I was trying to say, what does it mean? If you can lose these things, were they yours to begin with? You know, like, what does it mean to have them? And what did it mean to, you know, to know that the master recordings of Little Walter exists means a great deal to me. But if they're gone, you know, everything's going to be gone eventually. You know, you wait long enough and in a long time, there won't even be any record of us in the fossil record. There won't, you know, even the plastic will be gone, right? All the stuff that we worry about now, it won't.
No,
be.
No, the plastic will not.
No,
it'll be around
in the real long time. Not even a trace of us. And that, to me, it's very comforting.
All right, a couple more questions. This one is a question about you.
No.
Get ready. Oh boy. So, you wrote of the universal fire. Who's going to live in the mystery of the curve, the place between one and zero, where it's still possible to be a human in the real world? You seem, and correct me if I'm wrong, you live a very human life. You chop wood, you make fires, you read books, play guitar, drink coffee, you write, you paint. How is your humanness faring in the world these days when it comes to your profession or otherwise?
I think everybody has to work really hard to not have it be eaten away, nickel and dime, taken away from you. Mainly because in order to participate now, we have to, if you want to be a part of the conversation that the culture is having with itself, which is, you know, the working definition of a culture, right? We're just all deciding together who we are, what we do, why we do it, where we're going, where we've been. What does any of it mean? If you want to participate in that conversation, then you have to essentially pay rent to a bunch of corporations that have platforms that you shoehorn yourself into, right? Which when the web first started, everybody had their own website. They had to code it themselves. They all looked different. It was like a profusion of completely various and different flowers, you know, human expression. All these things were very open. And then the web got controlled, codified to the point where now we have, you know, everybody has the same Instagram page. Everybody's stuff looks the same. Everybody's photo filters look the same. So to me, like if I didn't do this job, I wouldn't spend a whole great deal of time dealing with the internet because I don't enjoy it. And I am deeply suspicious of what it brings to the table in terms of making our lives, you know, better, more meaningful, making our connections deeper. I mean, there are parts of it that are fascinating, parts of it that are, you know, for instance, I used to have to bring an atlas everywhere I went. And then for a while I had to just like print out directions everywhere and have this giant binder that I would have on my lap in the rental car. Right. And I don't miss that. It's nice to not think about that stuff, but it is all trade-off. You know, and whatever, you know, it's not hard to figure out what are the things that you lose over time. You know, you're like, oh, I miss how that felt. I realized the other day, I was cleaning my office this winter and I found a bunch of things that no one has to keep for 25 years, like phone bills and gas bills. And I found from back when I lived in Wisconsin, I found my phone bill and I was looking at the long distance charges. Right. And I remember being on the phone with somebody far away thinking, boy, I don't think I can afford this, but I'm not going to get off the phone because we're having a really good conversation. And it, you know, most nights I'd come home and I would, you know, make my dinner, get a little exercise, whatever I was going to do. Then I'd sit and read, and I would read, and I would drink beer, and I'd read some more. And then some nights I didn't feel like doing that, and I would call my brothers, and I would call my grandpa, you know, I'd call all these people and have just a phone conversation. And I haven't been on the phone for longer than about 5 minutes in a long time, because I have almost like PTSD about the iPhone device, because it's just, you know, follows you around. So, I mean, that's a longer conversation, obviously, but my feeling about digital technology is you have to be incredibly careful with it, because it will mess up your life, make it less interesting, yeah, and less fun.
I think that's a really good way to put it, to be careful with it. Some people choose to completely cut it out of their lives. Like John Moreland put a record out this year, and he went for a year without social media and 6 months with a flip phone. And he has his iPhone back or smartphone back, but I feel like sometimes I want to do that, like downgrade my phone, but I'm like, then what am I going to do about every, like, paying for parking, or like trying to find someplace like on Google Maps? Or
yeah,
I have a hard time with the streaming stuff too, with music, because
right, and then, you know, now
because I feel my perspective on streaming music, not to like fully dive into this topic, like we're at an hour, so I mean we could probably go on for another hour talking about this, but I've always felt like streaming, like Spotify, I don't use Spotify anymore, I use Tidal, but it's perfect for somebody like me who works in radio and just needs to listen to all sorts of different music at any point in time. Like, I feel like if streaming weren't around, I would probably like be so broke, because I would have to spend money on music all the time. But I know that it's like terrible, and it's getting worse. Yeah. And I just, you know, but I feel like I feel like, man, if we could just take streaming away from everyone except for me, that'd be great.
That's a solid plan. I don't see a problem with it. I would be happy to let everybody, just you have streaming. It wouldn't bother me at all, especially if that meant that we all got paid for what we do. I mean, I use the title as well.
I'm going to write to the president.
Yeah, that'll probably depends on who it is, really, but it might do something. You know, the technology thing, stuff like Spotify, you can get angry about it, and it's easy to do. It's also, you know, you're closing the door right after the horse got out of the barn, right? Like it's already a thing. Trying to convince people that they need to pay a reasonable amount to listen to music when they've been conditioned for 15 years to believe that information allegedly wants to be free. It's very hard to convince people to do that. But I mean, there are so many ways to think about the music industry, you know.
If you stop making money at this music thing, you could always sell your paintings.
Or start.
Or start making money, yeah.
Yeah. I do enjoy painting. Painting to me, I just give them to people, and I have only kept a few of them. At this point, you know, I'm such a neophyte painter. I have a good buddy named Carl, Carl Homstad, who's a painter in Iowa. He's old buddies with Greg Brown, and I met him through Greg. And Carl's a beautiful painter, so he, you know, he coaches me on painting, and then he sends me his poems, and I send back my notes on his poems. We have a nice little work balance. And to me, painting is like a discipline of experience and concentration, and I do it, and I enjoy the process. I used to get very frustrated with some sort of technique problems that I didn't really know how to deal with when I was like 17. Because until I was 17, until I started playing guitar, that was all I did was visual art, and I really enjoyed it, and I was kind of an obsessive. But I got frustrated, and then I couldn't figure out how to progress. And so I got to where I could make a very accurate rendering of something, and that wasn't interesting to me at all. So I quit. And now going back to it, every time I start painting, I'm looking at the ways that painting you know, poems, any kind of writing, songwriting, the way those things work together, music, or work similarly, I guess, the way they're geared similarly. Like painting what's there is not as interesting as painting what's not there. In the same way, like writing a song about a subject is not particularly interesting or useful to me. Like, you need the subject to begin the work, but then hopefully the, you know, the subject disappears and you, the actual subject of the thing that you're working on shows up at some point.
That sounds very similar to the way that I write interview questions, actually. I just write down a bunch of stuff, right? I find a bunch of stuff I find interesting, and then I start writing about it, and then all of a sudden I find the question. And then sometimes it's like a situation where you're like, this is a really interesting subject, but I don't have an interesting enough question to ask, so let's just keep moving on. It's cool.
Yeah, to me, writing a song about something is, you know, that's how you begin. But it makes you fall back on cleverness, you know, your ability to make certain words rhyme, that sort of thing. You know, after you've done it for a while, if you know what to do, it's the equivalent of like mowing the lawn or filling out a crossword puzzle, right? Like, I know how this goes and now I'm going to do it. And that's not an interesting way to write tunes, because you've just eliminated the best part, which is the mystery of the process of being alive and conscious. So oftentimes, especially with poetry, you know, like when you're working on something, or with a painting, like, you know, at some point when you're working on a painting, because every move you make is accretive, you're adding, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each time you add something, you're responding not only to the thing that you're seeing, which you're trying to recapitulate reality in front of you, but you're also reacting to every mark that you already made on the canvas. And at some point,
recapitulate, take a shot.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's a fun drinking game. So at some point, it becomes more about the what's on the canvas than what you're looking at. And now the painting is about itself. It's not about the thing that you were starting from. And songs work the same way. At least they should work the same way. Right? If you have a thing in your mind, you're like, I'm going to tell everybody this thing, it's going to be a terrible song.
Jeffrey, this is great stuff.
It's much more interesting to not know.
Great content.
Yeah, we didn't even get into that.
Well, listen, it was great having you on. Before we let you go, I want to do a lightning round. You ready for this?
Okay. What does that mean?
I'm going to ask, well, you know how I've been asking you questions and you've given me long answers?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you questions and you give me short answers really quickly.
That's the only kind I got.
Okay, great. Lightning round. Jeffrey Foucault, okay. What time do you wake up?
Right now, between 4:45 and 5:00.
Which lake is the greatest?
Superior.
Interesting. Okay. Jeffrey, what time is supper?
It depends who you talk to. I would prefer that it was at no later than 6 o'clock.
I'm with you. I am with you.
But some of us would like to live like Europeans and eat later than that. But I start to get ornery when that happens.
Okay, and what's for supper?
No, we won't name any names. Oh, man. That's incredibly various. Tonight, I think we're going to take some chicken that we grilled yesterday and cut it up and probably make a salad. Okay. Like a
classic. Seaweed. Classic.
That's my guess.
All right, a couple more. What is your favorite kind of cheese?
Probably a cow's milk brie, you know, like a burgundy style cheese.
Okay, very good. This is the last one. Where's the best place to make a fire?
In your wood stove.
Ah, what kind of wood stove are you working with?
That's my favorite place. I mean, I have a fire scar. We have a Danish stove called a Morso. It's double burning. It's pretty efficient. It's the right size for the house.
Sounds fancy.
It's one of my favorite objects. The nice thing about a wood stove is I don't know how fancy you can really get. It's all metal and glass, but and heat shield and stuff. But when my grandpa Frank died, he left a little bit of money to all the boys, and the amount was the right amount to install this wood stove. And so every time I look at it, I think about him, which is a really nice thing.
Nice. Well, Jeffrey Foucault, thank you so much for being on Basic Folk. I hope you have a lot of success on the road, and congrats on the new record.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Great.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can go to our website, basicfolk.com, or find us wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like maybe that friend who has an old pickup truck that he just installed a new radio on that has Bluetooth so he can listen to podcasts while he's driving his old pickup truck around the cornfields of the Midwest. Send it to that guy. All right. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.